Amy. Who are you?
A, I'm an award-winning scrimshander. B, I'm a moderately influential warlord.
Hmm.
C, I write personality quizzes for magazines.
Okay. Well, your hands are far too delicate for real scrimshaw work. And I happen to be a charter subscriber to Middling Warlord Weekly, so I recognize you. I'm gonna go with C.
And you? Who are you?
I'm the guy to save you from all this awesomeness.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, and with me today are senior editor Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
And associate editor Evan Dixon.
Hello.
And Perry Nemiroff.
Hi.
Today we will be talking about Gone Girl and David Fincher. Just to let you know, this will be a spoiler-filled podcast for Gone Girl. It's very difficult to talk about this movie without talking about the twists and turns. So, it's a great movie. You should totally go see it, bring a date, and then go come back to us. Listen to this podcast if you haven't seen the movie. So, I think, and it's so freeing to be able to talk about Gone Girl openly, because in my review I was like trying to duck around what to talk about, because the studio, to their credit, gave away nothing. Really, they just said, like, you know, did he kill his wife? He's on a media manhunt. It really is more like, did he kill his wife? And that's not really what the movie is about.
To be fair, Fincher said the reason that it took like 9 months to finish his deal was because he told Fox he wouldn't allow them to show anything from Rosamund Pike past Reel 2. And they were like,
right.
Really? And he was like, yeah, I'm not doing this movie if you're going to show anything past Reel 2. So he said that's why.
And they were like,
so
and they said, what? And was their response, what's a reel?
Probably.
Yeah, there's no reels in no Fincher hasn't seen a reel in over 10 years.
But
yeah.
I wonder if that changes though. I wonder if that changes later on, you know, like a month from now or 2 weeks from now, when they're trying to get repeat views, you know, they can show stuff that people have already seen and third act stuff where it's you know, you tease up the more scintillating aspects or something.
That's a possibility. I mean, it seems like a film that will... I'm, for one, I'm glad that it beat Annabelle. There was, like, the tracking was, like, Annabelle's going to kick Gone Girl's ass, mm-hmm. and then Gone Girl edged it out a bit.
Because I think,
Evan, wasn't
that.
It you on Twitter? Yeah, Evan, wasn't it you on Twitter? It's like, if you want to see a real horror film this week, go see Gone Girl.
Well, yeah. I mean, this movie has probably the most beautiful kill scene I've seen this year. You know, and I haven't seen Annabelle. I think it's great that two movies did well this weekend. And I think that, you know, people are like, oh, you know, you're voting for crap when you vote for Annabelle. I haven't seen it. But I actually think that people are voting for good movies because they're kind of really going to see it because of The Conjuring. So in either case, I think good content brought people out to the theaters this weekend. I don't necessarily, you know, if they got good content in return, I'm not sure if that's the case. But yes, I'm glad Gone Girl beat it because Gone Girl cost like $80 million or something and Annabelle cost $5 million. So Annabelle didn't even really need the money.
Yeah.
Gone Girl
well,
is
no,
also
that's the
very
thing.
Much the better movie, by far.
Yeah, I'm actually, yeah.
Yeah, and also it sort of, when you have like an $80 million success, it sort of says, now obviously not everyone now gets to make a movie like this, but it bodes a little better, you know?
Yeah.
Because it seems like when a movie like this is a success, it doesn't necessarily open the floodgates, but it does stop people from necessarily being like, bury this.
Mm-hmm.
That Hollywood, it makes them slightly less risk averse, even if it doesn't, like, now let's make a bunch of Gone Girls.
Well, yeah, I went to see it this weekend. I paid for it. I didn't have a press screening, but it was like, there was a line for it. And I've only ever, like, in the recent years, the only lines that form are for, like, Marvel movies. And I was like, this is exciting. Like, people are lining up for an adult movie. Like, this is a drama. This isn't. And I was like, looking at everything else that's out, I was like, there are no adult movies out. Like, people don't go to adult movies anymore. There's like testosterone fueled movies like The Equalizer. I wouldn't necessarily call that an adult movie, but this is a movie that's equally, you know, targeted to like all genders. It's not like, you know, this is for the boys or like here's a love movie that you can go see with your girlfriend. This is an adult drama with like complex characters, and people were lining up for it. It made a lot of money, so that was exciting to me.
Yes. Since you touch on gender, let's bring up that aspect of the movie, which is something that I find is one of the more fascinating aspects of Gone Girl. When I read the book, one of the things that really jumped out at me, aside from the twists, is that I think is I can understand how people might misconstrue it as misogynistic because Amy is a psychopath. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, I feel that that's not necessarily the case. Yes, she is incredibly dangerous, but I think what Gillian Flynn sort of turns on its head is this notion that the only woman worth saving is a virginal, passive doormat who would do anything for her husband, and that's the only person. We don't want a real woman. We want the victim. It is so much easier to accept her as a victim than someone who maybe, you know, who's clearly, I'm going to say dangerous, possibly insane, but way more interesting than the Amy on the page that she fabricated. And I think that that's a good challenge to readers. And I would also counter to any misogyny claims that Margot and Boney are very strong characters in their own right.
Boney's the hero of the movie.
I think
she's a female and
exactly.
She's the hero of the movie. I think it's misogynistic to say that it is misogynistic because, like, why can't the female be, like, crazy? Why can't the female lead be, a complex psychopath? Bad character.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think it's more massage. If she were just like a one-dimensional, just evil, like one-dimensional, just like ha ha man eater, maybe. But it's not. She's not that at all. She has layers, and she's someone that you oddly feel for. I mean, she gets this revenge on Nick, and yet on her calendar, it's like kill self. You know, it's like it's a weird sort of emotional cobweb of what her brain is. But that makes her so fascinating. And I think that's really what we want. We don't want too often strong female character means heroic female characters. And really, what we want are interesting female characters. And we definitely get that with Amy.
That's part of the reason that the character is so successful, because Fincher actually gives you access to her thought process. Yeah, she's crazy, but you could still empathize with what she's going through because you know every single step of her plan. And, I mean, she's crazy, but it makes sense what she's doing. You may not agree with it, but I understand why she's going about it the way she is.
Also, the misogyny thing, to me, I mean, it's people only looking at one side of the coin. I mean, the movie's about two people, right? So I think when you also examine the fact that, you know, it's a movie about who we present ourselves to be. It's a movie about the roles we play. So, yeah, you have Amy, and I think the thing that if you even just look at her story, you lose the misogyny angle when you have that screed against the cool girl, you know, who pretends to be willing to do all these things and subservient to her guy, and you know, like how that's the ultimate compliment is that you're not really a woman, you're sort of the most convenient version of a woman for a man to have. On the other end, the thing that further negates misogyny is the fact that, you know, Ben Affleck's character, I mean, he's not holding up his end of the marriage either. You know, he's cheating on his wife. He if she presented herself to be a sane overachiever, he presented himself to be this charming, like, you know, interesting writer, but he's really like this all shucks kind of Midwestern guy who was pretending to be this guy to get her, you know? And that's kind of what she, in the last kind of confrontation that they have in the movie before going downstairs and giving that interview, you know, she's saying, I brought out the best in you, you know, her definition of the best, and you know, you brought out the best in me, which means we're going to both continue to assume these roles forever. So I think to say that because Amy turns out evil to some degree, you know, I don't get that at all. There's so much outrage on the internet, you know, and to me this is I feel like this isn't really catching on, this argument, and I'm kind of glad. Because we got that, and you've got Boney, which is a phenomenal performance. It's not the showiest performance, but she's like the anchor as a movie, you know, and then you've got like Adam was saying, you know, you got Margot, who's played by Carrie Coon, who I'd never even heard of before, but she's fantastic as well, you know. So this is, I mean, women are embracing this movie as much, if not more, than men, which I think might speak to those accusations as well.
Kim Dickens' performances were definitely one of the biggest takeaways for me. I mean, when I posted that clip on the site the other week, it was that scene where they were doing the interrogation, and it was her, Patrick Hugin, and Ben Affleck. And even just in that 1 minute of material, I was just completely drawn to her and everything that she says. And her material was definitely some of the most engaging for me. I loved that. But I mean, Rosamund Pike's gonna hit it pretty big after this. You know, she's been in a ton of movies that we've all seen, but at the same time, she's still not a household name. And I feel like they would have gone with a bigger name, especially having cast Ben Affleck in that role. I thought they were gonna pick someone a little bigger for that, but I'm so glad she got the role, because really, after seeing what she did in this movie, it's hard to imagine anybody else nailing it as well as she did. And I think her work in this is a big part of the reason that the movie plays as well as it does.
I think this movie is another reminder that Fincher is one of the best, like, casting directors around. Like, as a director, he is so good at casting, at filling out every role in his movies with just, like, the perfect actor. And then also, you know, like, working them to the bone. Like, there are people that don't enjoy his process, but there's no denying that the results are phenomenal. Like, you look at this cast is stacked. Like, there is no weak link in this entire cast. Tyler Perry's fantastic. Even down to bringing back the guy who played Mike Mageau from Zodiac, who I know is Minkus from Boy Meets World. For like
Jimmy Simpson.
Yeah.
No, not
Jimmy Simpson.
Mike Mageau.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But bringing back him to play the kind of like aw shucks cop who's kind of like fumbling around the house a little bit.
Yeah, if this movie cast award, like company award, I just don't know what's going to happen. This whole cast is just fantastic. Ensemble. They need to be honored as an ensemble.
There needs to be an Oscar category for casting directors.
You know, there really should. I can't believe that there is none.
Coincidentally, most casting directors are women, but that's beside the point. I would also like to point out that in terms of performance, most useful one-dimensional character, Patrick Fugit.
Yeah.
Whose sole job is just to be like, I don't like Nick. Yeah. And yet, by being there, he makes Boney look so much even better. Just by standing around and having a really uninteresting character, it's really useful for the movie.
I think he's also the avatar for the thought process. And he sort of espouses this, you know, the simplest answer is the correct one or whatever. You know, at the end, I think his importance really comes across when Ben Affleck is sort of like, how did she get a box cutter, you know, if she was tied up? And he's like, just be happy to have your wife back, you know, when this is the guy who throughout the entire movie has been blaming him just because, you know, or not just because, I mean, he's a cop on the scene, he's, you know, but he's a very much on the surface guy. And I think that helps, you know, relay to the audience that everyone is going to more or less accept this story, you know, except for Boney. You know.
It's also nice to have that viewpoint throughout the entire film, because in the beginning it's very much a did he do it movie, and then it veers off from that, but Patrick Fugit's character always is in that same mindset, so to have that run throughout the entire movie is part of the reason it's got so many layers.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Matt.
Oh, I was just going to say that I wanted to touch on Rosamund Pike's casting, which I found her performance unexpected. From what I read in the book, the Amy I see was more of like a gentle Amy, like someone who doesn't seem offensive, whereas Rosamund Pike seems very cool from the beginning, almost very composed, like you never doubt her. And yet, the more I think about it, the more I think that works better, because I think had he gone in a different way, someone in the comment section on my review was like, what if Reese Witherspoon had played it? And I'm thinking about, like, that would have been bad in more than one way. But if we're thinking in terms of more like the girl next door, like, first off, it'd be difficult to buy someone as cosmopolitan as Amy as that kind of character. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I like that because she doesn't have this, like, girl next door facade, it doesn't make the reveal, like, a gotcha on that sense. Like, ooh, she was playing a character the whole time. But rather, she's writing herself as a character, but not as a cartoon. She had to make herself believable enough as a person, but not as an image, and let the words let people run away with an idea of Amy, rather than like, oh, but she also looks this way, and so looks can be deceptive. And really what it's more about is personality can be deceptive.
Yeah, if she'd been like a really sort of bouncy, effusive, warm presence. I think that, which is how I kind of imagined her when I read the book, the first half of the book, you know, first time I read the book, you know, like you have these things like I'm fat with love and da 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 da, and like her letters are so much more verbose in the novel. You kind of imagine this sort of chattermouth almost, and it's a different take on it. I was surprised when she was cast also, just because I couldn't see it, you know, from World's End and from Jack Reacher, where. I don't know if she was misusing Jack Reacher. I mean, I think she's a good actress. I think Chris McQuarrie is a good director. But there's something about Jack Reacher where she's just kind of literally a deer in the headlights the whole movie. And here, it's just like she's playing like three characters. I mean, like, I think the middle character in Act 2, I mean, this movie is an insanely long first act. But, like, if you, like, that you know, the brunette, bruised, puffy New Orleans version of her, and then you've got the Brian De Palma version of her, you know, in Act 3. I mean, it's three different characters, you know. So, I mean, she nailed it. Yeah, I just didn't picture it. I don't know who I pictured, you know, but yeah.
And I think that works, like Matt said, I think it works almost even better towards the themes of the film, and that, you know, at the beginning, Amy isn't as jovial. Like, her diary comes across as that, but as a person, she's a little more cool, like maybe even a little standoffish. And I think that goes to the fact of, like, you know, we wear these masks, but still some of our personality leaks through. And I think it's about the stuff that we refuse to see in each other. Whereas, you, like, Nick Dunn as well, like his, you know, Midwestern aw shucks routine, I mean, that kind of shines through a little bit, but it's when they're meeting each other and courting each other, it's what they decide to focus on in each other is what they want. You know, it's kind of about how you pick out the things that you really like and you think, you know, if anything else is a problem, I can change it about them. That's what I'll do. And so, and I think it's more about how they're ignoring these sides of each other that do leak through, because it would ring false if Amy just all is this, you know, bubbly, jovial person in the beginning, and then it's like, aha, guess who I really am? I'm this cold, calculating bitch. That doesn't make sense. I think that works really well in the film, because it was surprising to me as well, but the beginning. But I think thematically it serves in it's in service of Fincher's larger idea of kind of the mask we wear, but also what we decide to ignore in that other person when we like them so much,
and what we ignore in ourselves. Like, I'm married, and I think back to when I was starting to date my wife, and like, well, you know, I was like 10 pounds lighter, you know, I probably you know, it's weird, like, you know, I you know, it's like Chris Rock said at one point, you know, when you meet someone, you're not meeting them, you're meeting their representative, you know. So, like, it has me thinking, like, God, what are my kind of Nick Dunn moments, you know? I haven't drank six beers and played video games on the couch this week, you know, but I don't know.
But the week is young, Evan.
Well, actually, yeah, if you started on a Sunday. To me, Sunday's the end. But yeah. So I made it.
How much backstory do we get on her character in the book? Because I haven't read the book. So I was kind of wondering in the end if a lot of this was intentional. Like, if she knew that she was going to pull something like this the moment she started that relationship with him.
She does not think that in the book. You don't get that much more backstory. I mean, everything in the book, in the movie, is condensed, obviously. You get a lot more of dating and all that with her and Nick. But all the real pieces are there. All the information is there. What, more or less?
It's a movie more about subtraction than anything else. And Evan, what you're saying, like extrapolation. So the clues are hidden in there. So the scene where they're going at the gala, the Amazing Amy stuff is up, and you sort of in the book it elaborates that she feels a lot of resentment towards her parents, and that kind of knives out thing.
Yeah.
And I will say this about the movie and the book with Amy, and that I think that I think Amy works slightly better as an idea than as a character, just because she's such a master planner and is so able to you know, eviscerate people on a psychopathic level. For me, I mean, yeah, she's gonna put Nick on death row, but I felt super bad for Scoot McNairy's character, who's like, you're gonna be a sex offender for the rest of, like, oh my god.
Well, you know,
that
his
is, he got it
his
worse.
His character actually doesn't have it that bad in the book. I think in the book she drops the charges against Scoot McNairy's character. But to answer Perry's question, I don't think that she planned to do this to Nick. I think that the first 2-3 years were legit, and it's just sort of like any kind of sociopathy or whatever, you know, or I mean, I think there are flare-ups. You know, I think, like, you can try and be normal, you can try and be good or whatever, you know. I mean, like, There are serial killers who take years off between killings. You know, I mean, you convince yourself that as a psychopath myself. You
we have calendars.
You convince yourself that you're going to change, you know, and that you can get on the right path or whatever, and you know, then you can't, I guess. You know, I read a lot about. You know, my mom's a psychotherapist, so I
do think that. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's it.
I was going to say, I do think that Amy does work well, because I feel like the world of the film is an exaggerated one. It's realistic, but I don't think it's reality. And so I think that the heightened, I think it's an exaggeration and a heightening of these issues of facades and coupling, and not even necessarily marriage, but relationships and how relationships change over time. Because I think a lot of, like, so much of this stuff is so over the top, and Fincher, like, shoots it in a way that it doesn't become, like, veer over into camp or soap opera, but it's still heightened, it's still satirical. So I think it actually works that way, because it's a little stylized, like when she's covered in blood, which is Chris Tapley described as the hottest sex scene of the year, and I wouldn't disagree with her and Desi. When she's just like covered in blood, and that kind of look, like shiver she gives. I mean, this is a sociopath of a different order. It's not Seven, where it's a world that's a little more grounded in reality, and this is a psychopath that you could kind of envision existing. I think it uses that.
See, I feel the exact opposite of Seven. I think Seven is highly stylized, but go on. I'm sorry.
I think it uses the sociopathy as a conduit through which to kind of explore these issues of coupling and stuff like that, and put
Absolutely.
Them on a grander scale.
Well, I think that's why all three parts of the movie work, you know, just because. And this speaks to what Matt was saying of her as an idea, not as a character so much, because it really does attack the same subject matter from different angles, you know? Like, even, say, let's say Act Two is the breakup, you know? Everyone's broken up with a significant other, you know? You have that thing where you're, like, you're checking in on them, you know, you're grieving them, you're feeling your independence, you know? You can go out and do stuff you couldn't do when you were with them or whatever. And part of you is latched onto them, and part of you wants to know what your breakup. You know, you know how you feel about the breakup, but you want to know how they feel about it, you know? So I feel like, yeah, her as an idea is a great tool to examine all the ways that our inherent kind of narcissism, you know, inflicts damage on people. And I do think it is obviously stylized. I think we all agree that this one is stylized. Because, you know, I mean, you're basically making big what's in everyone on a much smaller level. You know, everyone has components of this stuff in them.
The combination of the two works like fantastically also, because it makes it, it's obviously very serious material, and she's off her mind and does terrible things. But I was surprised by how fun this movie was.
Yes.
I mean, I'm thinking about all these things that we're talking about right now, but just, you know, on the surface, I was incredibly entertained by this movie, and I cannot believe how many times I laughed out loud.
It's a very funny movie. It's interesting. I saw it, you know, here in LA. I've seen it twice, but the first one was a critic screening, and a critic came up to me who hadn't read the book. Was like, "Was the book funny?" I'm like, "I guess it was," but you know, in the book you don't get that sort of contrast like here, where she's like, "Find a local idiot," you know, and then you have the image of that of Casey Wilson or whatever going along with that. I mean, it's a really really funny movie, you know. I mean,
and that's go ahead.
No.
Well, I was just gonna say that.
Deep Hasbro thoughts.
Well, I think this, in contrast to Dragon Tattoo, I think one of the things that Fincher forgot with Dragon Tattoo is that he was trying to make a movie that's entertaining. Like, yes, there's parts of it that are dark and stuff, but that movie felt in parts kind of like a slog, and I don't hate that movie, but this movie is tremendously entertaining, and I think that Fincher knew that I think he had that in mind throughout the whole time. He wanted it to be an examination of marriage and relationships, but he also wanted it to be entertaining, and it flies by. It's 2.5 hours long, but it feels like a thrill ride almost.
There is so many reasons just to sit through this movie again and again.
Yeah.
I'm gonna buy the.
I want to definitely go see it again. I mean, the one more thing I did want to just interject though with the film feeling stylized. I think it does from a visual perspective, but I do feel again part of the reason I feel Amy is an idea is partially because she's the driving force of the film, like the thing that everyone gathers around, but also because I think. I don't know. I just don't see, like, Nick. I think Nick is kind of schlubby. Like, and maybe you see that as too exaggerated, but I see, like, Affleck putting on some pounds, not dressing too well, and just sort of slumping around. You know, his sister's, like, witty, but, like, still feels real. Mm-hmm. you know, by the way, we're casting again, Tyler Perry. Holy shit. So good. Such an ingenious. I mean, Adam was talking. I remember you were talking about this like months, like basically once Tyler Perry was cast, you're like, that's genius. And you were absolutely right. It totally paid off. And I would like to give special attention to Neil Patrick Harris, who has a greatly reduced role. Like in the book, he's around for a lot longer. Yeah. But here, he does everything that character does with far less time and makes it so much
His sequences in this movie are incredible. I mean, obviously we referenced it a couple of times, but just the blood scene blew my mind. Like my jaw just hit the floor. That has to be one of my favorite scenes of the entire year. And just with the humor wise, the part where she's watching the report on TV and eating the ice cream and he's just looking at her. I mean, nothing is said, but it is so damn funny.
Well, he's taking the ice cream away and he's going right back. He's falling into the trap of trying to make Amy someone she doesn't want to be, you know?
Yeah.
And let it be said that Ben Affleck's penis is not the only penis in this movie.
Yeah. My girlfriend was very happy about that. She was like, this is bullshit. I have to sit through boobs in so many movies. She was like, they need to be showing more penises.
So you get two in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, what was weird, when speaking of casting and that role, when casting was announced, I somehow got it mixed up, and I thought Tyler Perry was playing Desi. And I didn't know who was going to be playing the lawyer. I was like, Neil Patrick Harris maybe is playing like Patrick Fugit's part or something. But like, because you know, in the book, and maybe I'm racist, but in the book, the lawyer is white, and I just couldn't get past this good old boy lawyer. And there's the twist in the book with lawyers that he's got a black wife or whatever. But you know, I think someone was complaining about that. They were like, oh, this is whitewashing the thing by not having a black wife. I'm like, what do you mean? You know, they made the actual character black. They, you know, put a figure. You know, I think Perry's perfect in it. But I part of me was like, how is he going to play Desi? You know. I thought that would have been creepy too, but yeah, maybe he's a little bit old for that. I don't know how old Tyler Perry is. He's probably younger than Neil Patrick Harris. You can't tell when these people take such good care of themselves. But, sorry, that was a tangent.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I definitely want to, but agree that Fincher made this, you know, brutally funny. I think that humor is essential. Otherwise, it's just like. This film, I think, can't survive with without gallows humor, because otherwise it's unbearable. It's way too brutal, and it's pretty brutal as it stands. I mean, I'm watching this film and my mouth is agape, and I just watched Seven, you know, not that long ago, and I'm like, I can't decide which film is meaner.
Yeah.
And like, one of them has a fucking head in a box, and yet I'm looking at Gone Girl and I'm like, this one's pretty fucked up too.
I think Gone Girl, you know, I agree with you that I feel like Seven is stylized to the point where it's almost Gotham City, you know. But so I think that Gone Girl is almost more brutal because it's about the banal, and it's about how this is in all of us. You know, Seven is sort of like this sort of almost apocalyptic movie. But Gone Girl for me is just about, this is the way everything is all the time. You know, if that makes sense. I don't know if I'm articulating that right.
I think so. Something I want to touch on, because looking at some of the reactions, is some people have called it like trashy.
Yeah.
You know, and sleazy, and I never felt that with this film. I felt that like about Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and I think partially it's like, oh, it's airport lit. And when I picked up the book, I was like, oh, this will be an easy airport. It's like I'm picking up the Da Vinci Code, whatever, and Fincher will elevate the material. And I'm reading this book, and I'm like, this is actually a very smart book.
Yeah.
It may be popular. It's definitely a page turner that you could read on an airplane, but that wouldn't say it's vapid by any means.
Yeah, that's weird. Go ahead.
Oh, I didn't love the book. I thought the book was entertaining, but I didn't. I felt like Fincher's partnership with Flynn allowed them to elevate the material. So that's how I felt. But I never felt the film was trashy. I just felt it was Fincher bringing out those themes more and kind of fleshing them out a little bit more in the film. Because I wasn't a huge fan of the book. I enjoyed it, but I didn't think it was particularly enlightening. But I mean, I do agree that Flynn was getting at some really big ideas. And obviously her partnership with Fincher has just, you know, put the spotlight on those.
You know, I feel like people might call it trashy because there's just so many ways to enjoy the film. I mean, I guess I can see how that might happen if someone kind of just sat back and relaxed and just, you know, watched it for face value and kind of just had fun with the little knocks at how we handle media and all that stuff. But I mean, if you're sitting there and if you're engaging with the characters, I mean, I personally didn't find it trashy, but if I'm thinking why someone might, I guess I could see how a viewer might fall into that.
I mean, it's lurid. I mean, but David Fincher's films are all lurid except for Button and Social Network, you know? So I don't know. Yeah. To me, it's not trashy. I feel like it's a, you know what that is for me. And I don't want to say that anyone who uses that criticism is being disingenuous, but it's, to me, it feels like someone wanting to say they like the movie, but wanting to sort of put themselves at arm's length from it a little bit and be like, I know better. I, you know, like, this is a popular book. This is a popular movie. I am an intellectual and I can't say positive things about this kind of thing without some kind of qualifier.
Yeah. See,
but
and it's an interesting qualifier to use because I think the film directly attacks sleazy observations. I mean, the Ellen Abbott character, that's what's sleazy. That's what's sleazy. And the film is like, no, this is what's sleazy. That's what's predatory. What we are in is the cold vacuum of harsh truth, not sensationalizing it in the way that people would prefer it to be sensationalized. They would prefer if everything were on this, you know, scale of bring me a narrative, bring me, it's like, ooh, twincest, you know, throw that one in there, give, you know, make it that. To me, that's sleazy, that's, you know, speculative. And the film is saying, fuck that, what we have is not sleazy, it's entertaining, but in a completely different and more effective way.
No, I think so. And, you know, I mean, I think the Ellen Abbott thing leans into that in more than one way, too. I mean, the Ellen Abbott is an incredibly entertaining character, and I mean, she adds a comedic element, but yeah, I mean, it's also about, yeah, like, it's a movie about how things aren't as they seem, and, you know, how we, like you said, we require that narrative. Good girl, bad girl, you know? Like, we don't know. I mean, on TV, women go missing, you know, like the, not that we should be judging any of them, you know, but in order to gain any interest, they have to be a pretty white woman who was a perfect person, you know? And so I don't think that such a creature exists, but that's how the news has to define it to create a tragedy around it. You know, people, women go missing and are victimized every day. Some of them are, you know, different races. Some of them way more than others. Some of them, you know, aren't as pretty as, you know, Natalie Holloway or Rosamund Pike in this, you know? And it's about, like, the media selecting a story and saying, okay, this is an angel, this is the devil, you know?
Right. And I think, and I was thinking about that, like, why, I was thinking about just that thing, like, why choose Amy? And I definitely think that if this were a real thing, you would have to have the Amazing Amy book series.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you need to seize on that. And wow, how better to paint your victim to have Amazing tacked onto her name by virtue of her upbringing.
Yeah. Well, and I think in the book there's a thing where the whole thing kind of brings money back into the Amazing Amy kind of coffers for her parents a little bit.
I would have. I actually would have liked to have seen that in the film.
Yeah, I kind of wish the movie was 4 hours long, just because I miss things in the book. You know, like them flying, like trying to explain to the cops that it's not that expensive to fly in lobster and stuff like that. But I mean, I imagine there is a longer cut, you know.
Yeah, that's the thing. You almost wonder if he could have kept it in, just because, like Adam, you said, this movie just flies by. This is a brisk 2.5 hours.
And I think that's on purpose. A lot of the editing is really, it really kind of caught me off guard at the beginning, because it visually it feels so different from Dragon Tattoo, and it's Jeff Cronin with again, but, and everything is static, like everything's locked down, but a lot of it was just kind of not as stylized as Dragon Tattoo, like, because Dragon Tattoo, Fincher was actively trying to make what he described as an adult franchise, an adult R-rated franchise, so it was supposed to be big and expansive. But the visuals kind of in this movie kind of caught me off guard, because you had that kind of blinking editing at the beginning, even with the credits. The credits were kind of blinking, and that kind of threw me off guard as well. That was really interesting. I thought that was a really interesting way to go.
And it's kind of amazing how just text can do that, because I was staring at the credits thinking that too. Like, what it means something that you're doing this.
Yeah, and it keeps the momentum, because you're kind of... I think Fincher...
I mean, it's a guy walking to his job.
Yeah, and I think Fincher, you know, knew that he was making 3 different movies in this one movie, and the beginning had to be a mystery, but he knew that he had to make, you know, two other movies after that. And so it keeps things propulsive and keeps you on your toes. And I envy you, Perry, because I really kind of wish I'd have seen this without reading the book. I know everyone's talking about the twists and turns, and nothing really caught me off guard because I knew it was coming. But were there a lot of kind of like double takes and stuff like that for you?
Well, I've been saying this to everybody who's been asking me, because I seem to be in the minority with having not read the book. And a lot of people are saying, you know, should I read it first? I mean, this movie blew my mind because I went into it knowing nothing. And that's also having seen all the trailers and all the clips and all of that. So, I mean, I just can't believe the studio pulled it off and still let me go into this movie not knowing anything. But I'm kind of glad I did. And now it makes me want to go back and read the novel, because I feel like even though I have seen the movie and I do know how it ends, it's going to be more fun to read the novel and kind of get all these extra little elements that I didn't get in the movie. And knowing where certain things came from and like how certain situations affected certain people, like what you brought up with the parents, I'd want to know more. And it's nice to know that there's more out there that I have access to.
Were you genuinely curious if Nick had killed his wife? Because that was something for me that it felt like Fincher had kind of done away with that within the first 10 or 20 minutes, the doubt of it. Like, the more of the mystery was figuring out what happened, as opposed to did he do it?
Not entirely. I was going back and forth for a little while, and that's another thing that I loved about this movie, is there's so much like just flip-flopping with, do I like this guy? Do I not like him? Can I commiserate with his situation? Or maybe Amy was okay. I mean, for a while, she had me pretty convinced that, you know, he just kind of let go and ruined their relationship. But then all of a sudden, other things started to surface. And I'm like, no, that is not right. But then again, later on at the same time, even when she's going crazy, it's like, I do know why you're doing this. I get it. This is not the right way to express yourself, but still. So I kind of liked the back and forth between the two.
That's the thing. I overheard someone saying, Gone Girl has the best villain in history. And I'm like, do you not understand that movie? Like, they are both fucked up. They're both bad people.
Yeah. It's a scumbag and a sociopath. Yeah.
It's not about, like, oh, this poor guy. Like, were you not paying attention?
And they don't let that back and forth go until the absolute very end. Like, in that last, it's like I walked out and I kind of didn't know who I wanted to win at that point.
Yeah. It's kind of like made for each other. Like, they deserve each other.
In the worst way possible. I mean, the thing is, and again, I've read the book, so those opening lines of, you know, what's in your head, I want to break open your skull and watch your thoughts pull out, is sort of just the perfect way to set the tone. It's like, ooh, something loving turning to violence.
Well, that,
like, what a wonderful bit of foreshadowing.
That's in the book, too.
It is.
In fact, I picked up the book at an airport, read those lines. It's like, I don't want to read this book. And I put it down. I didn't read it. And I bought it later on. I bought it on my honeymoon. Read it on the flight to Hawaii. I think there's more there. You know, it's interesting, like, the people complain about the ending of the book. I think the ending overstays its welcome in the book. I think there's a lot of, you hear a lot about, I think in the book you learn about Desi's death when she's in the shower with Nick. You know, I think, but once you get into that space, it keeps going and going and going. And the movie kind of wraps up more quickly than the book did. I don't know how often, have you guys read the other Flynn books, the other two, Sharp Objects and Dark Places?
No. I've heard they're better than Gone Girl.
I don't necessarily think so. I think Gone Girl is more on its mind than either of those. I think Sharp Objects has a more satisfying ending, more conventional ending. Dark Places has an ending that's, and I like her as a writer, but Dark Places has an ending that is like, when you read that or when you see the movie, which I'm sure the ending's the same, it's so much coincidence, piled upon coincidence. At least the Gone Girl book is contrived, but it's contrived in a way that's brought about by action of the protagonist, you know.
Sure. Yeah, her taking believable actions, especially, and again, as an idea. Well, how would this idea rebel against Desi, who is this notion of, on the surface, like, oh, the sweet protector who's actually really a jailer.
Yeah. Well, he's like the Hello, My Lady type, you know, if you saw that Amy Schumer sketch.
The ultimate milady.
Yeah.
At one point, my friend, who's like at the press screening, turns to me. It's like, I'm envisioning his A Million Ways to Die in the West character right now. Is that wrong?
I haven't seen that movie. I hear he fucks a lot of sheep, though, right? Is that the thing?
He shits in a hat. But he is very milady. He's very dainty.
Oh, okay.
But we don't need to see. We don't need to talk about that movie. One thing. I wanted to, before I forget, the score.
Yeah.
So Adam, you said like people didn't like the score.
I saw some reaction on Twitter. Again, I was trying to just like dodge landmines all week because everyone had seen it, and so just the few that I saw didn't like it. I liked it. Another friend of mine did not. He didn't think it worked. I thought it worked in kind of a sick way. It's kind of like sickly sweet. It was interesting to hear Trent and Atticus use an orchestra for the first time. That was a little unexpected.
An orchestra comprised of one xylophone.
No, they hired a real orchestra.
No, I know.
Well, there's
it's a very xylophone-heavy score, something I noticed.
There's a really sweet theme right when he pushes her, and then it comes back when he's wheeling her down the hallway in the hospital. That's the most melodic piece of score they've ever done, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very, like, I think sickly sweet is the best way to describe it. It's almost mocking with what it is. It's like, you know, it's something that's like, oh, this would be really sweet. And yet there's this bitter undercurrent running throughout it where you're just like, this is like a distortion of what we would expect in an actual romance. It's like a robot trying to understand emotion.
Yeah.
And I was disappointed in their Dragon Tattoo score. I thought it was too similar to Social Network. Not that I didn't like the music, but it just in the context of a Fincher film, but I thought I did like the score. I thought it was really different and interesting.
I agree with Adam. I felt like after Ghosts 1-4 and then Social Network and then Dragon Tattoo, I felt like there's enough Trent Reznor score stuff out there. But I much prefer this one to actually most of that stuff. I think this is as good as Social Network and better than the other ones. You know, better than Tattoo and better than, you know, his other instrumental record.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Better than the last Nine Inch Nails record, maybe.
So, in terms of, like, Fincher's, you know, there's been a lot of articles. I mean, I did my retrospective, but a lot of people, you know, they're ranking Fincher films and then that great video essay, and everyone's, like, really putting attention onto him because this is his 10th film. Mm-hmm. And sort of his growth as a director. And something I admire about Gone Girl, and I think, again, what part of my problem with Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is Girl with the Dragon Tattoo feels very, because I think it's trying to feel lurid, it also feels very intense and overdone in a way that I understand why it may fit the material, but it also just, it feels forced. It feels stylized without the substance to back up that style, whereas Gone Girl still is stylized, but it has a subtlety to it. Like, it's just like this just an undercurrent where you can't necessarily place your finger on it. You know, when I see Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and I see, you know, the POV from, you know, night vision cameras, and I see the snow bearing down, you know, and the gas, like, you know, knocking out Daniel Craig, and, like, just these big, bold moves. And then when I think of Gone Girl, I just think of, like, a camera just creeping across the McMansion floor. You know, just, like, these little moments. Just, you know, or the washed out, you know, time, you know, where she's pretending to be from New Orleans, and it's this thing where it's like, oh, I'm among the Hicks, and it's like, but the color is drained here. You're not in control. You think you are, but you're not. It's like these. I felt it was more subtle, and it's
well, and it's also about something.
That helps.
Yeah.
That helps. although the people in the comment section on my Dragon Tattoo review also believe that movie is about something, and I disagree.
Yeah, it's not about anything. No one can. Who can relate? It's a movie about a Asbergian bisexual computer hacker genius who teams up with, in the book, a very pudgy journalist. In the movie, not so pudgy, and has sex with him for no reason, and they fight like Nazi like people on an island.
Nazi, incestuous Nazi rapists. So,
I will say the procedural aspect of Dragon Tattoo is incredibly compelling and well done. That's
No, I mean, Dragon Tattoo is not a bad movie. It's just the worst David Fincher movie.
Yeah.
I would say it's a bad movie. But but that's besides the point. Because this is, and although I will say, going to Gone Girl, I did have this trepidation. You know, it's like, is Girl with the Dragon Tattoo the start of a slide, or is it just an aberration because it comes from really crummy material? Because I haven't read the book, but I've seen the Swedish version, and I'm like, this is not any great shakes. Like, I don't see really what's working here, and I don't like, I think the character is very contrived, and it seems to be a lot of the plotting is terrible. Your protagonists don't meet until halfway through the movie, and yet I'm supposed to buy them as a partnership. It has a lot of problems, but I think Gone Girl, having read the book, is just better in every conceivable way. And it also it's a film that fits very much in his wheelhouse. Although and it's not that I like, it's like stay with what you know, Fincher, because I think in some ways I would describe Benjamin Button as a noble failure. Almost like I like what he tries with it, but this one is just, this feels like the David Fincher take Seven, move it forward 20 years, and you see a guy who's really matured but hasn't lost his edge.
Well, for me the thing is that it's fun. Like what's the other way? Benjamin Button is not fun. Like, I don't want to watch that movie again. Like, it could be good, you know, but, like, people think of Fincher as this really serious guy, and I guess he is. I mean, he's a very hard worker, and he's very in command of his craft, but he makes really fun movies. You know, they have an icy aesthetic, but they're fun. I think Social Network is a fun movie.
Yeah, I agree.
Even Seven is not a pleasant movie, but it's a fun movie. Like, Seven, you know, doesn't disappear up its own ass like 90% of indie horror movies do, you know. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, I'd say this is the first time since Panic Room it feels like that David Fincher was actively trying to make a movie that was first and foremost entertaining. Not to say his other movies aren't entertaining. Like, Zodiac is wildly entertaining, but it's more clearly focused on kind of other issues. Same with Social Network, is incredibly fun, but it's also, there's a lot there, a lot to dig through. You know, Machiavellian, but then Gone Girl, it almost feels like David Fincher's pop song, and like he knocked it out of the park. Like, it's fantastic. He wanted to make something that was just wildly popular culture entertaining, like entertaining to all ages. There's stuff to dig into.
For a fun for all ages, bring your kids to Gone Girl.
Oh, my, I will tell you, my Saturday night screening, packed screening, a lady had a baby in there that kept making noises and crying until, like, finally everyone got fed up and, like, talked to someone outside. An hour through, she finally got up, but I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, how selfish of you to bring your baby to, like, I'm not even worried. Like, I saw R-rated movies when I was like 4, but like, know your surroundings. Like, this isn't your living room. We're not enjoying listening to this crying baby and it was right before the big reveal, and I was like, you better get out of here before that, because you're gonna ruin it for everyone. Sorry, that was an aside.
It's fine. I wanted to say, though, Panic Room, that was a great call. I think you're absolutely right on Panic Room, because for Panic Room, he said, like, on the commentary, he's like, I always wanted to make a Friday night date movie. Yeah. And this is sort of an evolution of that. It is kind of a Friday night date movie.
Oh, it is.
But with something where you might look askance at your date afterwards.
I think it's a fantastic date movie. I think that, I mean, it gives you something to talk about afterwards, but it's also really entertaining. But I don't think you'll be looking askance. I just think it's a, you know, what do you think about that? I think maybe, I was talking to somebody, it was like, the test of Gone Girl is you take someone on a date to it, and if they have, like, the wrong opinion, the wrong reaction of, like, you know, maybe that's when you know, like, maybe this isn't working out, if you didn't really understand what was going on there.
Yeah, that's my dating tactic for every single movie I like.
Yeah.
That's how I'm
What, take them to Gone Girl?
Gone Girl's at the top of my list, though. I mean, I like a lot of his movies, but this is definitely going to be the one that I'm going to watch the most. I mean, even just going back and thinking about the scenes that I liked, I can't even pick a single one. Like, I'm going to get I know what's going to happen. I'm going to put the movie in, start it on VOD, whatever, and I'm going to be excited for every single thing to come. I love that feeling. That's what gets me to watch movies over and over and over. And I have that the most. I watch a lot of The Social Network, and I've seen Panic Room more times than I can count, but I actually do that the most with Zodiac, which is,
Zodiac,
I mean, I, you know, the disturbing stuff. I love that. But I can watch Zodiac over and over, but Gone Girl's going to beat it. I know it. And I'm already dying to see it again.
I don't know if it'll beat Zodiac for me, but I definitely think it's in his top five. I think that it's Gone Girl is easily better than Button, Alien 3, Tattoo. I think it's better than Panic Room. Yeah. You know, I would probably, I'm in the middle of rewatching Fight Club with my wife, and Fight Club is great, but, you know, I don't know. I mean,
we're gonna have some fighting words, Evan. Yeah. Gonna have some fighting words.
At
that point, though, I think it starts to become apples and oranges.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
To me, I think it's okay to have preferences, but someone in the comments is like, "Are you gonna rank the Fincher films?" And it's like, I don't know if that's like, the films are doing different things. Yeah. Like, am I gonna, like, I don't want to say, well, on their merits, like, they're definitely, I have preferences. Like, I think Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is the worst. But at what point it's like, well, I think The Social Network is better than Seven because murder? Yeah. Like, I don't understand. Like, it's just, they have the same director and they have, like, similar, you know, themes in terms of, like, what their director brings to it. But at that point, it's like, well, this is kind of frivolous, and it also undermines all the writing I just did.
Yeah, so, I can't really.
I could have made a list from the get-go.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think you can rank them. I think for me, like, the farthest I can go is say, you know, top five or six, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that'll, like,
Like, Social Network is my favorite because I adore Aaron Sorkin, and it's probably one of my favorite movies of, like, the last decade. But I'm not going to say you're wrong in saying Zodiac is his best. Like, I can't – they're not in a competition with each other. They're all so fantastic.
And they're doing different things. I mean, Social Network is a very much a commentary film with also sort of grand, dramatic, timeless storytelling things. Zodiac is very much an investigative thriller.
Yeah.
It's not a serial killer movie. No. It's an investigative. Fincher describes it as a newsman story, and I would kind of, you know, follow along. I would also say it's one of those movies that's far better than the book. I don't know if it's based. I think it's based on both Zodiac and Zodiac Unmasked. Mm-hmm. When I did the junket for Zodiac, they gave us free copies of Zodiac Unmasked. And I tried reading Zodiac. It's a mess. The book, it reads like it was written by a cartoonist, basically. Like, the structure is god-awful. And this movie fixed it.
You know, it's
No. I was just saying it's a great adaptation.
I have the script. I have an early draft of Zodiac. It's still the same writer. It's still Jamie Vanderbilt. But it's interesting to me, like, you know, it's probably written pre-Fincher, and Fincher came on. And even the opening scene, like, it's weird to see, like, you know, Fincher really, really steered that away from serial killer and action stuff. Like, the opening scene of the script is—it's the same characters. You know, it's the two kids, but it's like this car chase and all these hard lefts and turns, and, like, it's this really elaborate, like fast-paced kind of getting away from someone kind of thing. And the rest of the script is pretty different, you know. And I think the resolution is a little bit different as well. Yeah, it was interesting to see how Fincher really took all of the conventional. You know, I'm getting $60 million to make a movie by, like, who was that? Was that Fox or who?
It's Paramount.
You know, took all the stuff that they pretty much won in there out of it, and made a good movie. Didn't make money. You can see why they went it in there, but
They also, like, released it in March. It was like just poorly timed, and then. Yeah. It's a tough movie to sell because you are kind of like it's easier to sell as a serial killer movie, whereas, like, it's a movie where they don't catch the serial killer and people kind of their lives fall apart in the process.
That's why I'm so obsessed with it. It just, like, messes with your head to no end at the end of it.
I think I remember someone took, like, a screenshot of, like, an Amazon review of Zodiac, and it's like, they didn't catch the killer at the end. One star.
Something that's really fascinating about Fincher to me is his relationship with screenwriters. I mean, everyone describes him after they meet him as he's someone who can do your job better than you, and he learned it because he saw a bunch of other directors, you know, like a gaffer or a focus puller lying to him or saying, like, oh, I can't do that. And so he made it a point to learn that, but I know a lot of directors will work closely with a screenwriter in pre-production and get it to a place where they want it to be, and then, you know, kind of toss the screenwriter aside or, you know, don't check back in with them and just kind of take it into whatever direction they want to. But if you've watched any of the behind-the-scenes stuff on Fincher's Blu-rays, he works very closely with screenwriters, and especially on The Social Network, where I would almost go so far to say as Aaron Sorkin is, like, a co-director on that movie because he was on set for every, like, you know, offering input on every single take with Fincher, and you watch him, like, hashing that movie out in the pre-production phase. But he does seem
that's
to
actually
work
not
really.
That uncommon. I mean, you do it just depends, like, what kind of. I mean, like, a lot of people are on set every day doing that, but you would kind of, I guess, Fincher is one of the quote-unquote auteurs, even though it doesn't really apply to him, and I think that's why we sort of think of him that way. Like, you think of Paul Thomas Anderson or whoever, like you might not be surprised that you know, Drew Pierce, or who's going to, I don't know, like a regular director, Peyton Reed. You know, may not be surprised that Peyton Reed works closely with the screenwriters.
Yeah.
But, like, these people that you have built up in your head
as these, you know, masters of the form, you're surprised that they're collaborative.
Like Scorsese, or, you know, yeah. Scorsese does a ton of writing on his screenplays. He just, you know, directors don't usually get credit for that.
Yeah, it just depends. Yeah.
But I just think it's interesting because people think of Fincher as this, you know, all-knowing god, this, you know, exacting director who is doing everything on his own. But if you watch any of the Blu-rays, he works so closely, and you see, like, his working relation with Gillian Flynn has led to them doing an entire TV series next year. Like, clearly, he's very good to his writers, and his writers enjoy his company as well. Because I watch a lot of Blu-ray special features, and you can tell when, like, the screenwriter's, like, not in there or you know, kind of not offering input or anything. But with a lot of Fincher stuff, you get a lot of good stuff out of, like, Eric Roth or Sorkin, people like that.
Sure.
I don't know if you got a lot of good stuff out of Eric Roth on
I thought it was interesting. I thought a lot of the stuff he had to say about Roth and Fincher about working together was interesting.
I think what's interesting about how much they changed the previous script.
Sure.
But I will say, I think you're right. I think people might have a false notion of Fincher as sort of dictatorial because of how hard he works. But really what he's doing is that he's asking everyone to be at the top of their game. He's not saying, I'm going to do your job. But what he's saying is, I'm going to work you to the best of your ability. And if your ideas are good, I'm not going to dismiss them. But if we agree on your idea, you're going to commit to that idea.
Mm-hmm. What?
And so in that way, he is unyielding, but he is not just like, you know, you're my puppet.
Yeah.
What? I'd like to backpedal 1 second and say the address he didn't get much good out of Eric Roth. I actually think that Benjamin Button is every bit the movie it sets out to be. It's just not the movie I want to watch. Like, I don't think it's a failure. You know, I just think it's not my thing.
Well, that's part of the reason that I would put Gone Girl at the top of my list right now. I feel like if I did rank his films, I would rank it based on how rewatchable they are, because that tends to be what I enjoy most, the things that are entertaining and I can watch over and over again. Nothing wrong with Curious Case of Benjamin Button. It was fine when I saw it, but it's not a movie that I would ever want to revisit.
Mm-hmm. It's tough to revisit a 2.5-hour slow romance. But the thing, I guess my issue with Benjamin Button is that I feel it's at cross purposes. I feel that the script is much softer and more, quite frankly, saccharine, and that Fincher is sort of a cynic trying to play the romance, and he can emulate it. But the script is very much writing out these characters in broad strokes, which is odd for a director who's as precise as Fincher, and who can't really ever get rid of his cynicism. I mean, he can mask it, but when you hear, like, you know, Taraji P. Henson saying, "You never know what's coming for you," and I'm like, "That's in a movie where, like, a woman on her deathbed is slowly, you know, dying as Katrina bears down." It's a weird thing to have that romanticized notion in this overall picture, and I also feel that to lift it up as a life story, in a sense of a life best lived. Whereas Fincher is like, I think it's a movie about regrets, and yet I never really feel like a lot of those regrets shine through.
But I think the movie's a fable, so that stuff does work. Like, it's a fantasy film. It drops out a little bit in the middle, and I don't think it's as consistent as Fincher wants it to be. But it is a fable, which is why those lines like that, I think, work. It's not a movie that I love, and I was actually, I begrudgingly revisited it, but I ended up liking it a lot more than I thought I was going to, because I had seen it once. I had seen it a couple times before. I own the Blu-ray, but it's just not one that I don't love the first act, and it's one that's it's a bit of a slog. But I do think,
see, that movie,
I do think it's a fable.
I'm sorry, go
I do ahead. Think it's a fable, and I do think that heightened aspect of it. It's weird to think that Fincher's made a fantasy film, because you don't really think of it that way, but it is a fantasy film.
It's weird to think he's made a romantic comedy, but he has.
Yes, it's
Fight Club. But the thing about Benjamin Button, look, and here, I'll say this. Benjamin Button made me cry the last time I watched it.
Yeah.
And it's, like, unexpected, but because it's so well constructed. But even as a fable, it's like this dude bails on his family, and it's like, you know, he had to do what he did. I get it. It's like, what? This is a weird thing to say. It's like, sometimes you just got to bail on your family for spurious reasons.
Yeah, that part always sort of bugged me. I mean, I'm remembering that now. He just gets up and leaves, and it's why, because he's getting young and hot.
Like, so, like,
he's like, I can't, it's like, we can't explain to her daughter that I have a unique disease. He's like, she needs a father, not a playmate. And, like, she'll fucking understand that daddy ages backwards. Like, it's, like, give your kids some credit. It'll be, like, it's like,
happening,
you know, my family has.
Right in front of
I feel like that sounds like the title of a children's book.
Daddy ages backwards. We should. That should be part of the Golden Book series.
I'll go Photoshop something.
Please do. Please do. It should just start, like, and then, like, you know, oh my God.
Just sit it on the shelf next to Everybody Poops.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the thing. But but to your point, like, Benjamin Button is not really that much of a funny movie as well. Like, it is very, takes itself very seriously. It has a couple laughs.
If you could single out a quote-unquote Oscar bait film of his, that it would be that one. It feels Oscar-y. But I know that, and I don't know the story behind it, but I know that he and Paramount had a very contentious relationship on that, and he hasn't worked with them again since. That was, what, 6 years ago? Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he'll work with. I mean, hell, if you want to talk about contentious relationships, look at 20th Century Fox and Alien 3.
Sure, but that
and
was a says, decade eventually and a new regime later.
But that's what he and but that's his point. Yeah. It's like, yeah, there will be a new regime someday, and then I'll work with them again. Like, that's
probably
the thing.
Same with
he
Sony.
Went back to them for Fight Club, and, you know, like, people were like, how could you go back to 20th Century Fox after Alien 3? It's like, all those people were fucking gone.
It's like he makes the rounds while he's waiting for the regimes to change. Like, he's off Sony right now because of Dragon Tattoo, but he'll go back. Like, he's back at Fox now, and then he'll go back.
But are things so bad with Sony? I mean, like, I don't know of any real war animus between him and them, right?
It was with the marketing on Dragon Tattoo. Like, he went way over budget. They wanted to do things with Imara that he didn't want them to do. And so that's the reason he flirted with doing the Steve Jobs movie at Sony. But he was like, here are my demands. And they were like, nope, not falling for it this time. And he was like, okay, I'm walking. And so that just, I don't know if it's super acrimonious, but it's just kind of like, we've been down that road before. We trusted you. And Dragon Tattoo was a bit of a bust, box office wise. So this time, if you're going to work at Sony, you're going to work for us. And I think he's like, yeah, I don't really need that. So,
yeah.
Yeah. He has other things. He has a bunch of projects in the works that he can jump to and other studios. And I think he did. I wonder, and I think, you know, 20,000 Leagues was a bit of a, he got kind of bogged down in it. It was one of those, like, is this about to happen? Is this about to, and it's like, I think it created this 3-year gap, you know, between Dragon Tattoo and Gone Girl.
A while ago, a long time ago, I worked at a talent agency out here, CAA, and I was in the elevator with him, and he was going, not with him, you know, I just happened to walk into the elevator, he was there, but he had all this pitch artwork for heavy metal, and it was cool to see the ideas that he, and I forget who he was working on that with, did, because I think that heavy metal could have been pretty great, based on that and just his name alone, but I guess it never happened.
I feel one of these days he will do an animated film.
Yeah.
I just feel like he likes graphic novels. He worked really hard. Like, he wasn't going to direct The Goon, but he was really pushing for that movie to get made.
Yeah.
And, you know, he has a good relationship with Tim Miller, who is doing Deadpool, which I think is really cool. I forgot that Tim Miller did the opening credits for Dragon Tattoo, which is, for me, the best part of the film.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, he has good collaborators, and it's always exciting to see what he'd do next, and, like, so when I saw, it's like, holy shit, he's doing a TV series for HBO. I am so there.
It kind of feels like, it's so weird that he and Soderbergh are best friends, because their working process is so different from one another, whereas one is exacting, the other is kind of like, well, you know, here's what I'm going to do, let's try it, if it doesn't work, oh well. And it gets some great stuff sometimes, but it kind of feels like he's following in his footsteps a little bit, because it feels like Gone Girl is a bit of an answer to Side Effects. Not that the two movies are that similar, but I know that he and Soderbergh are close friends, and they show each other cuts of everything. And then with Soderbergh just having a blast on The Nick, and, you know, going back to do the entire second season of The Nick, it feels like Fincher was kind of like, "Let me try that. Like, that looks pretty cool."
You know, if you let me get indulgent for a moment, one of the weirdest stories I have from time out here, just coincidentally, is back in 2009, I went to go see The Hangover. In the lobby downstairs by the bar of the theater, I see Steven Soderbergh and his wife. I'm like, oh, interesting. And then upstairs, I see David Fincher and, you know, his wife or someone. And I was like, oh, there must be some sort of, you know, big screening here I don't know about. You know, they're showing somebody a cut of something. And so I sit down, to watch The Hangover, and they walk in with their wives, and their wives are like, "Oh, hey, let the boys sit together." And then they sit right in front of me, and so it's like it's watching Fincher and Soderbergh on a double date. But it's to see The Hangover, which is a movie you wouldn't imagine that they would ever go see, you know, like and you're picturing them. So I actually didn't watch the movie that whole time. Like, I was just watching Soderbergh and Fincher like watch The Hangover, which is the most bizarre experience of my life, you know.
Did they enjoy it?
I think so. I mean, they weren't like laughing the loudest in the theater, but it humanized them for me. You know, it was weird. You know, it's sort of like going back to Everyone Poops. You know, I guess everyone watches The Hangover. So
that's the sequel.
Yeah. We'll put that on the next. Like, we're making a little children's bookshelf. Daddy ages backwards. Everyone watches The Hangover. We're moving through it. So yeah, it's definitely interesting to watch his career and also like sort of the perceptions of him, you know, as his work ethic and the style of his films. It's like, oh, then he must be sort of this dark. Fincher must be this sort of dark, brooding guy. And really, he's just sort of like a, you know, I in some ways I see him as almost kind of self-deprecating.
Yeah.
He's really at times funny. And yeah,
I feel like
he's a really funny guy.
A lot of his sense of humor, you feel a lot of that. I forgot where I read it on The Social Network. I don't know. I think it was on the cast commentary. In the scene where Andrew Garfield and Jesse Eisenberg's characters just, you know, they become popular and they meet Brenda Song and that other girl in the bathroom, and they're waiting outside the bathroom while they like freshen up, and it's Josh Pence's cameo, who played opposite Armie Hammer, the other Winklevoss twin, but they removed his face. But he comes up and they're supposed to say, you know, like, oh, you know, some girls are freshening up in there. But they said one of the lines that Fincher threw out for them to say was, sorry, you can't go in. A couple of girls are sewing up their hymens in there. And it just like when Go has that line at the bar in at the beginning of Gone Girl, where she tells him what he should do to give his wood present to his wife, that it just felt like a Fincher line to me. Just he just has dark sense of humor that's just it's really bitingly funny.
Well, in House of Cards, when Kate Mara is on that date with that guy, and he's like, you know, do you want me to, you know, you're going to invite me up? And she just goes, and Fincher gave her the line, it's like, oh, if I wanted to fuck you, you'd know. Like that, and just ends the date that way. Like that was Fincher's line, verbatim. And it is, like, and it informs the character, and it's a really funny, dark joke. So, yeah, it's good to sort of see that in him, and that's another thing with Dragon Tattoo is I don't think it's particularly funny.
No.
Not that a film with that much rape needs some jokes, but it's something where it feels like he got wrapped up with the notion of like I get to make an R-rated franchise, but what does that mean? Mm-hmm. You know, what is that? And again, I think it's probably, I mean, Evan, you've read the book, right?
For Gone Girl or for
Dragon Tattoo?
No, I've read part of the book. Yeah.
Is it any good?
It's actually not that well written, but it could be a bad translation, you know. So
that's true. Yeah. That's true. It's actually the original title is "Men Who Hate Women," not "Girl with the Dragon Tattoo." That's not the Swedish translation.
I feel like having read the synopsis for the rest of the series was sort of enough for me.
The film's also the books apparently decline in quality as well. So, but again, back to Gone Girl, great rebound.
Mm-hmm.
Glad that it did well. It's very exciting, and it definitely continues to show his evolution as a director, which makes Utopia such a thrilling prospect to see him in long form.
Yeah, I hope Utopia is. I hope you. Yeah, you know, House of Cards for me sort of descended into
fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, I think House of Cards, if you watch that show every week, it would fall apart. I think that show benefits from binge watching because it's actually so boring, like a lot of the time. I don't know. Let's not go down that rabbit hole. He only did the first two episodes. I'm glad to see him doing an entire series, like Soderbergh did.
Yeah. Great. Well, does anyone have any extra comments? Gone Girl, Fincher, anything on the book?
No.
We're good. All right.
I bought the soundtrack. I own the book. I'll buy the Blu-ray.
Yes, I'm definitely. I'm like, I'm like, Perry. I gotta see this movie.
I will
again.
Likely go read the book soon too.
Yeah, and I'll be interested to get your thoughts on it after you have read
it. I'm curious because most of the time, I mean, I've written a couple of those book to film adaptation pieces, and most of the time, I have read the book before seeing the movie. I don't really think I've ever had the reverse experience, so I'm kind of curious to see how that plays out.
yes, that would, yeah, that should be interesting. I'm always sort of on the fence, like, do I want to read the book before I see the movie? And now I'm like, I'm probably going to read Inherent Vice before I see the movie.
I would highly recommend that. I would highly recommend seeking out all information possible on Inherent Vice before seeing the movie.
Especially since Thomas Anderson said it's not supposed to make any sense.
Yeah.
Well, but here's the thing.
Unlike The Master, which is a totally sensible, easy to follow.
Yeah. The Inherent Vice, I have that book, and I haven't finished it. But you know, I am waiting for Paul Thomas Anderson to make sense of that book to me. Now, I don't actually expect the movie to make sense. I don't need it to. I kind of know what he's going for, I think.
Sure.
But if you're looking to that book for answers, you're looking in the wrong place.
Hmm.
I don't know if it's answered. I'm just trying to hope that maybe it goes down easier than Crying of Lot 49. That was a work of postmodern fiction that I was just not for me. So I'm wondering.
It's Ping Chan's. It's definitely Ping Chan's most accessible book.
That's probably a good way to describe what I wanted, though. Something that went down a little easier. Like, I thought I was putting too much work into it.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about Inherent Vice, but that's not till December.
Yeah.
So we're Fincher, Gone Girl, good stuff. Let's move on to recommendations. Evan, what have you got?
I recommend All Things Gone Girl. I don't know.
All right.
Y'all go ahead, and I'll come up with something more inventive.
All right, Perry.
All right. So I've been posting so many New York Film Festival reviews, and they're almost all negative. I haven't really liked very much. But the few things that I have liked, I haven't reviewed because we already have reviews of them, and they've been playing at festivals all over the world.
And, okay, just talk about your recommendation.
All right. So I have been posting a whole bunch of New York Film Festival reviews, and I'm sure some of you have noticed they are negative, but I've seen a couple that I really enjoyed, so I want to talk about one because, first of all, it's fantastic, and also I don't want you to think I hate everything at New York Film Festival, but a couple of the movies that have played there that I really like, I haven't reviewed because we already have reviews of them because they are excellent and they are playing at film festivals all over the place, and one of them is Whiplash, which I absolutely adored, and I think this is going to make Miles Teller kind of above and beyond even what he's become. I'm almost a little disappointed that he's doing Fantastic Four right now because I'm not entirely sure how that one's going to turn out, and I want to see something of this level from him again so badly, but this is a great movie. I used to play an instrument as a kid, and I was always good at reading sheet music but never was good at improvising. And it always used to frustrate me because I always knew that that's what kept me from being, you know, great at it or moving on to a higher level. So I was really able to connect to his character in this movie. His name is Andrew, and he's a drummer at a conservatory. And he doesn't want to just be a good drummer. He wants to be the greatest. He wants to be the best. And to be the best, he needs to get into J.K. Simmons' class. His name is Fletcher in the movie, and he needs to be in his band, and he's like a super tough teacher, and it's kind of trying to get you to figure out, you know, is he too tough or is he bringing out the best in this kid? And I love the back and forth between the two of them. I can't believe how exhilarating and suspenseful playing the drums could be. I mean, if you think about it, how many ways can you cover playing the drums? But I mean, they just do a brilliant job. Damien Chazelle, this is just fantastic. I'm a big fan of his, and I absolutely cannot wait to see what he does next because he does so much with this movie. It really blew my mind. And this is another one that I just want to see again and again. I really enjoyed seeing Miles Teller's character grow throughout the movie and how he dealt with the situation, and I want to see it over and over. It is coming out, I believe, this weekend. I'm not sure if it's a wide release or if it's a limited release.
It'll be a limited release. But
I really just cannot recommend this movie enough.
Yeah, I've integrated Not My Tempo into my lexicon, my daily lexicon.
Who was it? Oh, Ed Douglas from Coming Soon. He made a Not My Tempo t-shirt, and I was very amused by it.
He's starting your work for you, Sony Pictures Classics.
That's what I said to him. I'm like, you should show them that, and they should just print more of those. I would
wear one. I would totally wear one. Adam, what about you?
I've read some quite a few articles and comments saying that Rosamund Pike's amazing Amy in Gone Girl would not be unwelcome as a Hitchcock blonde, and so I am recommending Hitchcock's 1958 film Vertigo, which also kind of deals with duality and twists and turns. It's interesting because whereas Gone Girl is one of Fincher's most entertaining and kind of populist films, Vertigo is Hitchcock's one of his more esoteric and kind of more dense films, and it was not met with an enthusiastic reaction upon release, but subsequently gained favor. It's not my favorite Hitchcock film, but I think it's a really interesting one. The filmmaking on display is really, really incredible in Vertigo, and it's doing some really interesting things. And the structure of it is odd as well, because it kind of resolves the conflict two-thirds of the way in. If you've never seen it, it stars James Stewart as a former detective, current private investigator, who's hired by an old school friend to follow the friend's wife, who is apparently behaving strangely. The man believes that the wife may have become possessed by her grandmother, who was an immigrant and went insane and killed herself. And so there are some twists and turns. The woman's played by Kim Novak in a really fantastic performance. Again, it deals with duality. There are, you know, quite a few turns and twists and stuff like that. But it's a really interesting film in Hitchcock's filmography because it feels unlike a bunch of his other movies. He was kind of considered a very populist filmmaker of his day. And this one is very strange and very odd. And stands out in a way, but it does. It did remind me a bit. Seeing Gone Girl reminded me a bit of this movie, and I think it'd be an interesting rewatch to watch in context of Gone Girl fresh in your mind. So if you haven't seen it, see Vertigo. If you have seen it, I suggest giving it a rewatch sometime soon.
Okay, Evan, got anything for us?
Yes, Starry Eyes. It comes out next month. And to me, it's a horror movie that I suppose ties into Gone Girl in the sense that it is about someone who's very much playing a part, and it's about this actress who kind of makes a Faustian bargain to get a part, and it has a metamorphosis in it that definitely rivals Amazing Amy's reveals in Gone Girl. And it's a very small horror movie. It was made for about $200,000. And I think it comes out on VOD, limited theater, that kind of deal next month. And I had the honor of hosting the Los Angeles premiere of it last week, and I've seen it several times. And I actually can't recommend it highly enough. It does have a lot of gore at the very end. So if one woman threw up at the screening, but it's a, it's actually a very, but it's a very fun, funny movie. You just got to close your eyes for about a minute. At the end, if you're averse to gore, so but yeah,
I second that pick.
Thank you for the fair warning. My pick is gonna be Fight Club. It's one of my all time favorite films, and I had kind of forgotten it was one of my all time favorite films because, in what is undoubtedly an elitist, snobby move on my part, Fight Club sort of it didn't tank at the box office, but it definitely underperformed, and it was missold, and it got really mixed reviews, and then it really found life on DVD, and it was the first DVD I ever bought, and I fell in love with it, and I watched it all the time, and I would recommend it to people, and I loved discussing it, and then it became more popular, and it's like, it's not mine anymore, you know, now it's been misinterpreted, and all this stuff, and I got really snooty and shitty about it, and so I hadn't watched it in a long time, but I rewatched it for this Fincher project, and I just fell back in love with it all over again, and just how funny it is, how witty, how smart, how well-constructed it is, how brilliantly the voiceover is used. I think it is just, if we want to talk about David Fincher being funny, I think this is by far his funniest movie, but it's also very sad and thoughtful, and it's this most recent rewatch, it's like, it's also a love story. That's the thing. It's something that really jumped out at me. And it's one of those films where I think some people are now put off by the fact that the twist is so well known. And I try to explain to people, even if you know the twist, and I knew the twist going in, someone had spoiled it for me, the twist is so well executed, it doesn't matter. And I think those are the best twists. Like, I know the ending of The Usual Suspects, but that ending is played to perfection. And I could watch it
100 times just how well it's played. And it works in the sense of the film. It's not a gotcha twist. It makes a lot of sense. And the whole film just works together so wonderfully. And I think if there is something frustrating about it, it's that Fincher has done it so well that people are lured into thinking that, like, it's gospel, that it is actually preaching something when it's actually not. It's not, or therefore it is hypocritical, because how can you have this anti-capitalist character, but, you know, the director makes commercials and has even made a commercial starring the movie star who plays the anti-capitalist character. Mm-hmm. So it's something where I think people have misinterpreted it from time to time, but it's still a fantastic movie. I love it. I am angry at myself that it took me so long to watch it again. So my recommendation is Fight Club.
A side note, if you haven't seen David Fincher's recent Gap commercials, they are fantastic. He directed a series of Gap commercials that are running now, and I think Jeff Grunewald also shot them. But they are delightful. They're really fun.
They really are.
Yeah, so I would highly suggest seeking those out. They're really playful, really smart, really fun.
Yeah, he's never left ads. Like, he keeps doing them from time to time. It almost works sort of like a laboratory for him. He's like, I want to try this. I don't want to do an entire movie out of it, but I can try this and see how it goes. And that's really fun to watch. But yes, definitely check out those. So yeah, thank you for listening, everyone. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you should follow us on Twitter. Evan, where can we find you on Twitter?
You can find me at Evan Dickson on Twitter. I think that's it. EvanDickson.
All right. Perry?
You can get me at PNemiroff, PNemiroff.
Adam?
At Adam Chitwood.
And you can find me at Matt Goldberg. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.
Thanks for having us. All right.